Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
And welcome and good morning. I'm Harry Miller, and I am one of the attorneys with the Herzog Law Firm, conveniently located in Albany at Corporate Woods. We also have offices in Saratoga Springs, Clifton Park, and Kingston, New York. And we are here each Saturday morning to talk to you, answer your questions about estate planning, Medicaid planning, asset protection planning, wills, trusts, estate administration, beneficiary designations, IRAs, all those good things that affect people, that affect your estate, affect your planning, affect how your beneficiaries receive your assets, and how to plan for your future. Should you need long-term care, either at home or in a nursing home, or have home health care aides come in and take care of you. So welcome this morning to the Herzog Law Firm's Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour. You can reach me. I'm on my own this morning. Not my co-host. My co-host this morning is John Gabriel.
Good morning, John. That's right, yes. Harry is all by himself. I'm in another room somewhere.
You know? He is. Actually, yeah. So no, you can reach us here at the studio at 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900, because I'd like to have to do a monologue for the next hour. So pick up the phone and give me a call. There are things I know that are on your mind that you think about, that you worry about at night in terms of estate planning, passing on your assets, making sure that you don't completely dissipate your entire life savings on a nursing home someday. So love to talk to you this morning. It is, by the way, Labor Day weekend, which is one of the reasons I'm here by myself, because everybody else is away this weekend. I guess I'm not, you know. I think all the other people who participate in the radio show are off doing Labor Day things. I know one of them is taking one of her kids back to college, and other ones out doing other things. So I'm lucky to be here this morning. But I was thinking about Labor Day, and I looked up, you know, Labor Day is one of the oldest holidays that we have. I mean, other than the things like, you know, religious holidays like Easter and Hanukkah and, you know, Christmas, things like that, Thanksgiving. But it's been around for like 130 years and since the 1890s. And I was thinking, wow, well, how did Labor Day actually come about? And I thought, well, so I'm looking around on the internet, and interestingly enough, Labor Day didn't start out as a federal holiday. It actually started out around 1882 as at the end of the Industrial Revolution, when workers were basically, the average worker was working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. Child labor laws hadn't gone into effect. And one day, the first Labor Day parade was in New York City in 1882, I believe, where the workers essentially just took an unpaid day off and held a big parade in New York City. So there they were. And what happened was, over the years, 1882 was the first Labor Day parade, but they didn't, in fact, the federal government didn't enact Labor Day as a federal holiday until for 12 more years, until 1894. And what happened in the interim was each state, about 23 states, adopted Labor Day as a state holiday, not a federal holiday. And then at some point, I think it was Grover Cleveland or somebody like that, was convinced Congress to enact it as a complete holiday. So it wasn't just something that the federal government decided to say, oh, let's develop a holiday to honor workers. It didn't exactly happen that way. It was kind of the workers gathering themselves to celebrate and also to work on, you know, getting things like 12-hour days, 7 days a week, and children 6 and 7 working in factories and mines to have some. Of course, that was the beginning of the union, you know, union organization, the union movement. So it was really kind of interesting how it developed over the years. Anyway, Carol, and it's connected, I think, is our first caller. Carol, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you this today?
I'm just fine. How are you?
I am excellent. Excellent. What's on your mind this morning?
Well, I just had a simple question, I think. I had made out a new will with you folks, mm-hmm, in 2019 or 18, something like that. It's on the table here. It sure doesn't matter. But I have, that's my latest will.
Yes.
And I discovered uh-huh, that I had an earlier will made back in the 70s.
Okay.
when my mother passed, and I thought I'd better make a will at that time. Now, does the I have two wills. Now, does the later dated will automatically supersede the old one, and I don't have to do anything formally about canceling the first will?
That's a fantastic question. It really is. And you know what? I'm glad you called it your latest will and testament. I really, you know, it's not your last will and testament till your heart stops beating. Because you might make another one next year. You never know. So,
right.
I always say that to people. Now, you know, Carol, if you look at the first page of your will, it says, I, Carol, residing in the county of Schenectady, wherever it happens to be, being of sound and disposing mind and memory, declare this my last will and testament. And then it says, hereby revoking all prior testamentary instruments that I made before. So in the first paragraph of the will, you are revoking all of your prior wills. Okay?
So my question, I guess, is, do I have to cancel the other one formally or any kind?
No.
I don't want anything, any confusion after I'm gone to say, well, still, I don't care. She still had this other will, and this is what she wanted, you know.
I understand, and that has happens on occasion.
Yep.
And it's really going to be the opportunity to introduce to you something that is, it's really isn't that complex. But there's something called when you sign a new will, it's the concept of dependent relative revocation. So, that's a mouthful. Dependent relative revocation. When you sign your new will, the revocation of the old will is dependent upon the fact that your new will, A, is properly executed, and B, that you were actually mentally competent at the time you made the new will.
Okay.
So if, for instance, someone challenged your new will and was successful in saying she didn't have the mental capacity to make a will at that time, what would happen is the new will, the current will, the latest will and testament would be invalid. And then under this doctrine of dependent relative revocation, we would go back to the prior will. Okay.
Oh, I see.
As opposed to having you die without a will. Okay. So.
Okay. I'm unusual. I have two wills.
Well, lots of people. I probably have five. You know.
Oh dear.
I mean, I've been making wills since I was probably 30 years old.
Yeah.
And I'm more than 30. More than twice 30. So over the course of people's lives, it's not unusual to make four or five different wills.
Okay.
And it's very likely that you the people who are in your current will are not the same people or the same proportions that were in your prior will.
Right.
And that's where everything comes in. So it rarely happens. It actually, I must tell you, many years ago, I had a case where a woman had, she had three sons. And she had quite a lot of money at the time. She had several million dollars. And so originally, one of the sons was sort of a... He liked living large. He liked living large. I remember what happened was in 1976, during the bicentennial, Ronald Reagan, I think, was – no, maybe Jimmy Carter was present.
Yeah, Carter.
Carter was present. Okay. And they had this big fireworks in New York Harbor. And this is before 9/11, and you know, you could fly planes. So this guy chartered a plane in Long Island out in Islip, and flew his girlfriend over New York Harbor so they could see the fireworks together. And guess what? He charged on his mother's credit card. All right. And she kept bailing him out, bailing him out. So when she died, her last will and testament left him about maybe $300,000 or $400,000, and the rest of it went to the other two kids. So guess what, Sonny boy? Nobody is ever happy when somebody leaves you less than an equal share. So he brings an action. It's a hoity-toity law firm in Long Island, and challenges the will, saying mother was while she was physically ill, she was not mentally incompetent, and she knew exactly what she was doing at the time. So long story short, we later discovered about you know, 6 or 8 months into this litigation, we found a prior will that she had made in Florida 15 years before, like yours, a long time ago. that a law firm in Florida, because she had a house in Florida also, and guess what the previous will did? It didn't leave Sonny Boy a nickel.
Oh,
it left him nothing. So we got back in touch with the law fancy dancy law firm in Long Island and said, hey, guess what? If you win, you lose.
Oh, great.
The case was quickly settled.
I'll bet.
Okay. So
well,
that's what can happen. It's rare, but it can happen.
Even though I had heard something about a later dated will would automatically, and I must have read it in the will, and now I can't find it at the moment. But anyway, I thought somebody had said to me, but it could cause a lot of confusion if another will is out there.
It should. I mean, here's what a lot of people will do. They will simply physically destroy the old will. All right?
Oh, okay.
Now, I don't know. If we did the prior will, we may have the original will in our file. All right? You may only have a photocopy or a conformed copy of it. I don't know. But if you want to check, you can call me. I mean, it's pretty obvious to me talking to you on the phone, although I haven't seen you face to face, but that you appear to have requisite mental capacity such that your current will should not be challenged by anybody, okay?
Right.
But if you would prefer, some clients prefer to just tear the old will in half. And you know what? We keep the ripped up will in your vault file with it, okay?
Oh.
We don't put them in the shredder. No.
I see.
Okay?
Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Okay, because the company that I did it with early on, it was my mother's
Your mother's attorney,
lawyer.
Okay.
No, it wasn't with you folks.
Okay.
They just called me and said, we're going out of business. You know, everybody's died that was here earlier.
Sure.
So, anyway, come pick it up.
Right. Well, that's the correct thing they're supposed to do. I mean, it's really interesting to me because sometimes this happens. Lawyers, particularly solo practitioners, you know, they retire, they die, they move to Arizona.
Yep.
Under the ethic, we are obligated ethically to get in touch with the client because we are holding your original documents, okay? They don't belong to us. They belong to you. It's kind of like the stuff, I hate that we're going to get political, it's kind of like the stuff Trump took from the White House. It belongs to the people of the United States. It doesn't belong to him, all right?
Yeah.
Your will belongs to you. We're just storing it for you for safekeeping. In any event, we have to make arrangements either to get the will to you or you tell us, no, you forward my original papers to the Herzog Law Firm because they're now my estate planning lawyers or whatever like that. But we find situations where a lawyer has died and you know what? The widow just, they packed up the boxes. God, sometimes they're in the bay. Sometimes they just disappear. It happens. And that's why it's really important to stay in touch with the law firm, particularly if they have your original will. And if you have concerns, the will belongs to you. The problem is there aren't any great places at home. You stick it in a drawer. The worst place to put your will is in a safe deposit box.
Okay.
Because if we don't have access to the box, then we have to get special approval from the surrogate. We have to get special order to get into the box, to get the will, and it takes time. So
now tell me, my power of attorney has a copy. Would that suffice?
No. A photocopy of a power of attorney, if you took it to a bank, is no good. All right? Ordinarily.
Well, I mean, she's got a copy of the will.
She has copy of the will. She doesn't have the original will.
I think.
We would, if we did the will for you, in all likelihood, your original will is in our vault, along with the original copies of your power of attorney, okay? Because we don't want your agent to be able to simply willy-nilly use your power of attorney without your permission, as long as you're competent. If your agent calls me up and says, hey, you know what? Carol's in the hospital. She had a mild stroke. You know, her school taxes are due in September. I need to be able to access her checking account. We'll check that out. She'll come in and we'll give her either the original or an attorney-certified copy of the power of attorney, and then she can take that to the bank, and she can access your checking account to make sure your taxes, your homeowner's insurance, and all that stuff, your health insurance premiums are paid.
All right, well, thank you very much for all that information.
I'm glad you're listening. And if you have any other questions about your documents and stuff, just you can always call me next week or whenever it's convenient for you. Cool.
All right.
All right, thanks,
Carol.
Well,
thank you, and have the rest of your holiday weekend. Enjoy.
That'll be great. You know, I do the show today. You know, I do the show today, and then you know, what do I have tomorrow? For Saturday, Sunday, Monday. It's you know, pretty good. Thanks for listening.
All right. Bye-bye.
By the way, I mean, Carol's in Schenectady. I don't know if any of you have been. Yesterday, John, I don't know if you've seen this. Have you?
What's
any
that?
Of you seen the Van Gogh exhibit at the Schenectady Armory?
I had heard about it. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you. I went. My wife went earlier this week with some friends, and she said, "You got to go." So we went yesterday, and it was interesting because we went to the one in New York last year, a year ago. Mm-hmm. It was in New York at the. Oh, my, it's like the 23rd Street Pier. It's like in Lower Manhattan.
Okay, yeah.
In an absolutely horrible neighborhood. to get to the 23rd Street Pier, okay, first of all, we found a parking garage where you could park the car for 3 hours for less than $100.
Yeah.
Then you got to walk from the park underneath the FDR Drive, okay? Mm-hmm.
Okay.
To get to the 23rd Street Pier. And it's in probably this 300,000 square foot warehouse. It's absolutely, and it was wonderful. It's a wonderful, it's called an immersion exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
but you know, the one in Schenectady, it's a different exhibit. It's completely different than the one in New York. And I thought the one in Schenectady was as good, if not better, than the one in Schenectady was as good, if not better, than the one I saw in New York.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Really wonderful. And
yeah.
You go through, and it traces, Van Gogh was a, my God, he only lived to be, he committed suicide at 37. He
mm-hmm.
didn't live
very young,
a prolific painting. He painted over 900 paintings and 1,100. He was schizophrenic and had terrible psychotic episodes and seizures and epilepsy. And I would urge everyone, I think it's there till like the end of the year. And if you haven't seen it, I would really urge you to go. It's extremely well run, and it's a lot of fun.
What was one of those the famous paintings he did? Starry Night?
Is that
the most famous,
Starry
I think?
Starry Night is probably the most famous
now,
painting.
Did you see that in Schenectady?
Yes.
Oh, great.
Well, it's not the paintings.
Okay.
It's like a light show.
All right, I see.
It is a constant motion. This isn't like going to a museum and looking at a painting on a wall in the Metropolitan Museum.
Oh, that's great.
This is in a large room in the armory. And everything is fluid and in motion, and it gets bigger and smaller, and it changes and it moves. And I think for me, one of the things I thought was the most interesting was when you look at a painting in a museum, you're looking at it at a particular moment in time.
Right. Right. Yeah.
But that's not how the artist sees the painting when he or she is painting the picture. They set up their easel at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And the sun is rising in the east. The wind is light. And as the day goes on, the sun moves, the light changes. The breeze may increase.
Mm-hmm.
It may start to rain or the sun may come out. And that's what the artist sees during the course of painting the picture. And I think this gives you some conception of what the artist is actually seeing during the course of painting the
picture. Because there's movement.
As opposed to just this one little...
Right.
Snapshot.
Yeah.
Of a photograph, because that's all it is.
That's
anyway,
pretty cool.
Cool.
Wow. Yeah.
I liked it, and I would recommend it to anybody.
It's great.
So we were talking when Carol's on the air just about powers of attorney, and they are the power of attorney is one of the most important legal documents. I would say in some instances is almost more important than a will, because today most people today. Their assets don't pass under the provisions of a will. A lot of people today have trusts, revocable trusts, Medicaid asset protection trusts, whatever kind of trust they might have. the other thing, most people's assets are in beneficiary form of some type. If you're married, probably most of your assets are joint with your spouse. If you have a retirement account, like a 401k plan or an IRA, you have a beneficiary on it. You don't want that asset to come through your will or your trust, except under very unusual circumstances, because it's going to affect the distribution schedule and possibly increase the amount of income taxes you have to pay on it. So these are all very important considerations. But the power of attorney is the thing that, as Carol said, puts someone in charge of your financial affairs if you can't act independently, if you lose your marbles, if you develop mid to late stage dementia, Alzheimer's, or you're just physically infirm and you can't write your name anymore. So it's really important to have that in place. A lot of people have old powers of attorney. If your power of attorney is more than 10 years old,
it's too old.
You really are. You know, it's still good.
Okay.
The old powers of attorney are still legally valid.
Mm-hmm.
But last June, the state legislature reissued a new, I laughingly call it the short New York statutory short form power of attorney. 11 or 12 pages long. I said, I would like to see the long form power of attorney.
New York State for you. Yes. Oh, man.
It is gargantuanly long. It is impossibly complex. And I wager to say most people who sit and down and try to read it probably won't get past page 4 or 5. All right. And they may not even understand half of what's in it. But that's the form we have to use. That's the form the state legislature and the governor approved. And if you don't use that form, guess what? You take another form to a bank. They don't have to honor it. They say, "Oh, this isn't the right form." Now, your old form from 15 years ago is still legally valid. I mean, 15 years ago, we used a form that was 3 pages long.
Yeah, right? That's the one for my mother. That's
right.
What it was. Yep.
And you know what?
Very easy to understand.
The new form pretty much says everything the old form did instead of in 3 pages and 12 pages. Okay.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
So that's kind of what happened. But here's the problem. You take this old 3-page form from 2007 to the bank. The branch manager, they don't remember these old forms from 10, 15, 20 years ago, because guess what? The branch manager was in middle school 15 years ago.
That's right. That's right, yeah. He's never seen that before.
I don't know. Well, okay, so maybe we'd have our we might have to have our lawyer, the bank's lawyer look at this before. So guess what? Now we're delayed a day or two.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Get the new form. Relatively inexpensive thing to update. Also, the other thing people don't do from time to time is look who they appointed. All right? Who did you appoint 10 years ago? Look at who your agent is.
That could change over time. I mean, all kinds of things could happen. You're right, Harry.
Right. Is it the same thing? Hey, you know, I mean, had my daughter was a backup to my wife on my power of attorney, but guess what? She's moved to California.
Yeah.
And although she can do it, it would be more convenient for my son, who lives in Latham, to do it from now on. So.
Yeah.
Look at those things from time to time, because just the way things were 10 years ago, it might not be the best thing for you to do at this point in time. So there you go. The other thing that I'll get into just briefly. We've had a couple of situations in the last week or two involving financial advisors, all right? Financial advisors are great. They are great at giving financial advice, all right? Stocks, bonds, composition of your portfolio. What are you looking for? Growth, income, long-term gain. You know, what's your risk tolerance for the market? But sometimes they cross the line a little bit, I have found, and they think they're lawyers. And they cross the line from giving financial advice to giving legal advice, all right? And I don't know if you're a financial advisor out there listening to me. Just, you know, I'm not criticizing you. I'm just saying that these things happen from time to time. So we had a client who was in the process of doing one of our Medicaid asset protection trusts to protect assets from a nursing home exposure down the road. The financial advisor says, "Oh, what do you need a trust for? All your assets are in beneficiary form." So another question, well, what do I need a trust for? Well, what they need a trust for is because having your assets in beneficiary form doesn't protect them from exposure to a nursing home. All right? If you have your daughter on your joint bank account, if you have your assets payable on death to your kids, guess what? If there's nothing left in the account when you die, there's nothing to pass on to the kids.
Right.
It doesn't protect anything.
Right.
And financial advisor... You can put all your financial assets in beneficiary form, but you can't really put a piece of real estate in beneficiary form without creating tax problems, creditor problems, and all sorts of problems. So one of the things these things do, you know, if you put your children on a deed with you, if you deed your children your house and you retain a legal life estate, all right, guess what? If your son or daughter loses their job, has financial problems, hasn't paid their taxes, is involved in a nasty, acrimonious divorce, their creditors could have some, put a lien on your house possibly.
Not good.
And so beneficiary forms work for financial assets in certain circumstances, but they don't protect money. Example number two. Client has a large life insurance policy, all right? Potentially taxable estate, all right? Life insurance agent, life insurance guy, financial guy says, oh, don't worry about it. Life insurance isn't taxable. Wrong. When you die, the value of your life insurance is includable in your taxable estate, all right, for estate tax purposes.
And I bet a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah. So I think what the financial advisor confused, because he probably isn't an attorney, yeah, or isn't a tax expert,
right,
or a tax advisor, is that when people are the beneficiary of a life insurance policy, if you receive a $100,000 life insurance policy from mom or dad, it's not income taxable. You don't pay income tax on the receipt of life insurance like you did if you got a $100,000 IRA and you liquidated it. You'd have to pay income tax on the $100,000. Not so with life insurance. But it's taxable in your estate for estate tax purposes. There are differences between income taxes and estate taxes. So the way to protect that, which was our recommendation, is to put it into an irrevocable life insurance trust. And that way, if you have a large life insurance policy in an irrevocable life insurance policy in a life insurance trust for 3 years, guess what? It's not part of your taxable estate either. So beware. You know, we like financial advisors are really good, but if you get into situations, you know, always consult with your attorney, consult with us about those things. So we'll be right back after the break.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for, options available for Medicaid planning, and more. With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany, West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs, Executive Woods in Clifton Park, and 130 North Front Street in Kingston, our attorneys are here to help you. If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David, Jane Marie, or Harry, please call us during normal business hours, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581. Our Saratoga Springs office, 518-581-8131. Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010. And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405. Let the Herzog Law Firm help navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
And welcome back. I'm Harry Miller. I'm with the Herzog Law Firm. As you just heard from the announcement, we have offices conveniently located in Albany, Clifton Park, Saratoga, and Kingston. And I'm here this morning for the next half hour to talk to you, answer your questions about estate planning, Medicaid planning, asset protection planning, estate administration, all those good things. And you can reach me at 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. Just a quick note. We have webinars. It's September 3rd. Wow. And you can tell that the chill is in the air a little bit. When I got this morning, it was only 58 degrees, I think, out here. So it's a little chilly, but September is here. This is the last official weekend of summer. And we'll be doing webinars in about a couple of weeks on September 20, 21, and 22. It's webinar week. So on Tuesday the 20th, we'll be doing a webinar on aging in place, which is something everybody prefers to do. Wednesday the 21st, how to plan your estate. Some interesting elementary guidelines about getting your estate plan together, the kinds of things you need to gather, the things you need to think about. And Thursday, September 22nd, our ever-popular seminar on wills versus trusts. They are all at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You can go on our website at herzoglaw.com and register online if you choose. We will send you a Zoom invitation, which you can join as well. If you don't have a video, you can always do the audio instead of just the video. And if you have any questions or confused about how to sign up for it, just call the office at 518-465-7581, and we will help you through that process. Next month, Social Security, next month, I'll get to that in a minute. Wow, we're on a Schenectady roll this morning. Carl in Schenectady. Good morning, sir. How are you? Good morning, Carl. Uh-oh. Call back. Hello.
Beg your pardon, Carl, call back.
We'll get you. We accidentally dropped you.
Yeah, that was my bad.
Nothing personal.
Wrong button.
Call back.
Call us back, Carl.
So next month in October, guess what's happening in October? Your Social Security cost of living adjustment increase is going to be coming along. And this year, I mean, inflation being what it is, I mean, it's not so great when you go to the gas station. But the predictions are, so far, that your Social Security check is going to go up anywhere from 8 to 10% in January. So it will presumably help a little bit offsetting some of the other things that have been going on as long as that could be.
Again, for Carl in Schenectady, I beg your pardon, Carl. Maybe he couldn't hear us. And if you're listening now, Carl, yes, call us back.
Okay.
He may have been on his phone and not had the radio on, so maybe you didn't hear. So we're sorry, Carl. Call us back. We're ready for you.
We're here at 518-476-5900. Let me see. One of the things people are hesitant about is being able to be eligible and qualify for the Medicaid program. Most of the things that are, hang on a second, because I think John is bringing a call in here for us. So be patient just a second. And are we all set? Good morning, sir. How are you?
Very good.
Oh, there you are. Sorry we cut you off.
It happens. Yeah. On my last visit to my doctor, he gave me paperwork for a living will and a health care proxy.
Oh, okay.
Once I fill them out, do I put them in my wallet, hang them on the refrigerator? Where do they go?
The doctor probably gave you what is the standard, the New York State form of healthcare proxy from the health department? Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, that's something, well, first of all, you fill it out, and you should have it somewhere. The most important person who needs your healthcare proxy isn't you. It's the agent who you appoint. All right? So.
Yes.
If it's your spouse, you put the first choice is my spouse. Make sure you put one or two alternate people there.
Yeah, they ask you for two.
First, my spouse,
yeah.
And then my daughter,
yeah.
And then my son. Okay, because guess what? If you and your wife are hurt in an automobile accident and they take you to the emergency room, you can't act for each other.
Yep.
We have to have somebody else, a child, a brother or sister, a niece or a nephew, somebody else who can step in. Also, be very clear, put their phone numbers, not just their addresses, put their phone numbers next to their name, because that's how you get a hold of the healthcare agent, all right? We don't need if they live at 123 Maple Street. We need to have their cell phone number, or if they have a landline. These things come into play in emergency situations when we need people to act quickly and make life and death decisions about medical care, treatment, life support, and things like that.
Very good. What do I do with the living will?
Well, you keep them together. The living will,
okay.
the health care proxy part of it is, now did he give you two separate documents or?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, here's what I do. In our law firm, we combine the health care proxy and the living will are all in one two-page piece of paper. All right? The health care proxy itself is about four little paragraphs in which I appoint my wife, if she can't do it, I appoint the next person and the next person after that. That's the healthcare proxy, the appointment of the agent. The living will part is to give them guidance about what you want done, all right? If my doctors determine that I'm brain dead, all right, or I'm going to die from an underlying illness and quickly, like I'm not going to make it through the weekend, all right, I don't want to be kept alive on a respirator.
Or a feeding tube or any of that stuff. Yeah.
You also, in New York, you must also specifically give your agent the power to decline tube feeding and hydration. Otherwise, if the doctor decides you're getting the feeding tube, you're getting the feeding tube. All right? And most people don't want that. I've had situations where people come in and say, oh, my God, they put my mother on a feeding tube. She lived another 3 weeks. It was just horrible. If you have to specifically say that with those two things, tube feeding and hydration. Now, I have clients who don't want tube feeding, but they do want hydration. All right? There are people who, you know, have different views about these things. Hydration just means they're going to continue to provide your body with fluids. All right? They're not necessarily going to take any emergency steps other than that. So the whole purpose of the living will is to express your desire with respect to your end-of-life care. Did the doctor give you a most also or not? Did he give you a pink piece of paper?
No, he did not. No, they're both so New York Healthcare and New York Living Will.
Yeah, okay, good. Because I don't think a lot of these doctors have been giving out MOLST. Having a MOLST is another health department form. It's an acronym that stands for a medical order for life sustaining treatment. And they're having people fill these out who, in my own view, don't really need them at this point. I think these are for people who have some chronic degenerative illness. Cancer, Parkinson's disease, dementia, and you want to kind of outline a course of treatment and as the disease progresses. I don't think a perfectly healthy person is a candidate for a MOLST these days, but some doctors are promoting them. But that was the thing. And if you're not sure, I think the main thing is to get everything filled out that you want. Or on a rare occasion, I have a client who wants to be kept alive no matter what, you know. Plug me in, keep me plugged in. That's very, very rare, but there are people who choose that method. That's I would say maybe 1 in 100.
Very good. Thank you for your help. I have something to do today then. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for listening, Carl. It's a critically important document that a healthcare proxy we want to be in charge of the things that we do. I think I had a client one time who, and I think the thing you have to remember about a healthcare proxy is think carefully about the person you are appointing. All right, a spouse is usually the person who we're going to appoint, but not necessarily always. These things come up, for instance, in second marriages, all right? In a second marriage, do you want your second spouse to be in charge of that? Do you want your children from a prior marriage to make those decisions? It becomes a little more complex. When choosing children, you know your kids probably better than anybody, all right? Except maybe their spouses. So think about who the best person is. Listen. Doing a power of attorney for somebody is a lot of responsibility. It's a lot of effort keeping their finances straight, although most people don't have particularly complicated finances. But, you know, you've got to not only pay their bills, you've got to make sure their health, you know, health insurance, you have to file their income tax return. At the end of the year, you've got to make sure their income taxes get done and their taxes are properly filed. There's a lot of things. If you're a power of attorney for somebody who has a house, you better get out the homeowner's insurance policy and make sure they have some adequate insurance in case there's a fire. You need to look at all those things, utility connections. You look at the wear and tear on the house. They're important things to do. But it's a little different than making an end-of-life decision to terminate life support for mom or dad or Aunt Helen. So think about the person who's going to do that because it may not necessarily be the same person who's going to be your power of attorney. If you go out to dinner with your family and your daughter's looking at them, everybody's ready to order, and your daughter's looking at the menu and she can't decide whether she wants the pork loin or the lamb chops, you know, she may not be the best person to make the final decision to end life support if the doctors say that you're brain dead. All right. You have to have someone who, as I kind of say,
choose your family member wisely, I think is what you're trying to say, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Choose all of the people. This becomes so important when picking executors, trustees, power of attorney, and healthcare proxies. Look at your family, because they're all kids are not alike. I mean, most family kids can be very different from each other. They have even though they all have the same parents, they don't necessarily have the same outlook on life. And I often say one of the things I see in picking a trustee or an executor is, if you have a child who is a control freak, all right, somebody who wants to take charge of everything, I'm not sure that that person is the best choice for an executor or a trustee. Because sometimes I find those people are not transparent with their brothers and sisters. They like the control aspect of it. You know, the control of information is power. Controlling information is power. And if you're the executor of dad or mom's estate, you're the trustee of dad or mom's trust, the one important thing, and the reason that it's successful, is if you share information with your brothers and sisters, because you're all beneficiaries of the trust or the estate, even though only one person is the executor or the trustee. So, what was that Indiana Jones movie? But choose wisely. Yes, with the old guy. In the
and especially when
choose wisely.
He chose poorly.
He chose poorly. Yeah. We all remember
you
what
don't
happened to him.
Do that. Yeah.
Anyway, that can happen to your estate too. It can blow up, you know. All of a sudden, you have a massive family meltdown, which we would like to avoid in all circumstances. So these things are critically important to do. Just by way of, since I did start talking a little bit about what a MOLST is, it can be an important document for people who have, as I said, potentially terminal illnesses like cancer, or degenerative chronic cognitive or neurological diseases like Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's disease, even people who have, for instance, you know, advanced congestive heart failure. What I find with the MOLST, which is this four-page pink, it's a four-page pink document that, frankly, you can go online to the health department and get one. And you fill it out. In my experience, most people fill it out incorrectly. Or worse yet, somebody in the doctor's office fills it out for them. And I find that is often done incorrectly as well. Because among other things, in that document, in managing the course of whatever illness you might have, there are instructions and directions from you with respect to a DNR, with respect to cardiac resuscitation, with respect to tube feeding and hydration. And it's like a multiple choice test. You have like three choices with respect to resuscitation. I don't want resuscitation. I want resuscitation in certain circumstances, or I want resuscitation no matter what. Resuscitate me if you can. Those are things that a lot of people fill out incorrectly, I have found, and then the problem is it's there in your chart. You've signed it, the doctor signed it, and it's there. So we want to make sure those things are filled out properly, because the medical order for life-sustaining treatment is not just a medical document. It has legal implications with respect to end-of-life decisions and things like that. So I would caution everyone to just make sure it's correctly filled out. If you're not sure, you really ought to consult with somebody like us to make sure that you have that you understand what you're agreeing to when you check each particular box. The choice is yours. But I think a lot of people don't understand the implications of the boxes that they picked. Big red flag. Oh, selling my house in my trust, I think. By the way, if you want to call us here, we got about, 10, 12 minutes left in the hour. I am at 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. So, one of the most frequent questions I think we get when people are calling us up is, I put my house in my asset protection trust, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Some of these trusts are 20, 25 years old. And now we're selling the house. Can we do it? Can we sell the house if it's in our trust? Well, of course you can. Of course you can sell your house anytime you choose to if it's in your trust. I have a client just a few weeks ago who is living here. He's now well into his 80s, and so his wife has passed away. He's decided to sell his house here. And guess what? He's moving to Florida because that's where one of his kids lives. So his house has been in a trust for probably 15 or 20 years. So what happened is, very simple. Everything works just like the house wasn't in the trust, with one or two exceptions. So you list the house with a realtor. You sign a listing agreement with the real estate company that's going to sell the house for you. You get an offer along with a deposit, and you want to accept the offer. So you sign. The only difference is the contract, the listing agreement, are signed by you, the person who's living in the house, and whoever the trustee of your trust is, because there are two components to your trust. The trust owns the house, but you own the legal right to live in the house. So both of you, the trust and you individually, both have to sign the listing agreement, the contract of sale, and both of you also sign the deed. Now, because your house has been in here so long, the money from the sale of your house is also protected from asset protection planning and exposure to Medicaid. So all of those things are very important to know. So what happens, we go to the closing. The checks at the closing are going to be payable to your trust. You know, Harry Miller Family Trust. Payable to my trustee as trustee of the trust. Before the closing, we're going to go to a bank or a brokerage firm, and we're going to open up a bank account or a brokerage account in the name of my trust. So we have a place to deposit the money when we get the checks at the closing, or if the money's wired, depending on how a lot of money is wired these days at closings. So we put the money in the bank account, and guess what? It goes from the house being in the trust to the money from the sale of the house being in a bank account in the name of the trust. And guess what? The money from the sale of the house is immediately and instantly also protected from having to be spent on your nursing home. I'm going to take a break now and switch gears and talk to Diane in Rotterdam. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Could you tell me the difference between a regular power of attorney and a durable power of attorney?
Oh, sure. Yes. Well, this actually goes back decades and decades and decades. And so from a historical standpoint, years ago, I think even when I started practicing law in the mid-70s, powers of attorney weren't durable, all right? They were a power of attorney. You could sign a power of attorney now, and the person could manage your affairs and take care of your financial advice. They could sell your house. They could sign a deed. But guess what? If you became mentally incapacitated back in the 1960s and 70s, all of a sudden your power of attorney was no good. It was invalid if you became mentally incompetent. All right? Now, what do we have to do? We had to bring on – somebody had to petition, initiate a legal proceeding, go into court, and be appointed your guardian. All right, which is a court proceeding in which you're appointed guardian. It costs money. Everybody has to hire lawyers. You have to do periodic accountings. And it was completely unnecessary. A lot of this stuff that was in the law years ago was really designed by the legislature to generate legal fees for lawyers. Because, you know, 3/4 of the legislature is lawyers. So, wow. So one time in the 1970s or early 1980s, somebody finally woke up and said, wait a minute. If this guy was perfectly competent to appoint a power of attorney when he signed the power of attorney, there was no question about his mental capacity. And 10 years later, he has advanced dementia. Why shouldn't the power of attorney still be okay? So they came up with this concept of durability. It was durable. It still was okay, even if you lost your marbles. All right. So the power of attorney at that point had to have a provision in that said, this power of attorney will survive my subsequent incapacity or disability, period. That made it durable. So even if you had a medical diagnosis or neurological diagnosis of dementia, your agent could still act on your behalf, and they didn't have to go into court and bring, what used to be called a guardianship proceeding is now we have an AI, an alleged incapacitated person. You know, it's a, so it's the same thing, but it's a legal proceeding. Now, what's that?
That's great to know, because I had a regular power of attorney, and I said, my niece is an attorney. She said, we better get you a durable power of attorney. So I had her do that.
Yeah, that's really good, because I don't think, if your old one didn't have that language in it, and it might not have, then I think if you became mentally incapacitated, they'd have to go and do a guardianship proceeding in court under Article 81.
That's great to know, Harry, because I really didn't know the difference. And I did sign the durable power of attorney, I really wasn't sure what the difference was.
No, and you know, here's what happened. Here's what the change is now. I was talking earlier in the hour about the new power of attorney form that the legislature enacted last June. And then prior to that, there was one that was in effect for several years. The new power of attorney form is automatically durable unless you say it's not. The other one, the old form, was not durable. It didn't survive your incapacity unless you said it did. Now the new form automatically survives your incapacity unless you say it doesn't, and no one would ever say that. You know, it would be silly.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting.
So that's the thing, because, you know, an Article 81 guardianship proceeding, I mean, even an uncontested Article 81 guardianship proceeding today in New York, I'm guessing would cost anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000 in legal fees, all right? Uncontested.
Terrible.
And here's why. Here's why. Somebody comes in, you're incapacitated, you don't have a power of attorney, and believe me, we've got people who don't have powers of attorney, who are 82 years old, and all of a sudden they have a stroke, they develop Parkinson's dementia or something like that, and nobody has the legal authority to act for Ann Helen. So here we go. First of all, Ann Helen's niece hires a lawyer to be appointed her guardian because she's the executor in her will. Well, the problem is the executor in the will doesn't have any authority unless Ann Helen's dead. All right? The will doesn't
That's
kick
right.
in until you die. All right?
Right.
So nobody can act for her while she's alive but incapacitated. Now, she hires a lawyer. The court appoints a lawyer for Ann Helen. All right? Because Aunt Helen has to be represented. The court has to be convinced. She's called an AIP, an alleged incapacitated person. All right? And so the court has to be satisfied that she's adequately represented. And that, so now we got, there's two lawyers. Then there's a third person, also usually a lawyer, who's called a court evaluator. Court evaluator is going to go out and visit with Ann Helen, talk to her. Maybe she's in assisted living or something like that. He's going to look at her medical records, talk to her doctors, and he's going to file a report with the court that says, yep, Ann Helen definitely needs a guardian. Well, that person, all these people get paid fees out of Ann Helen's money.
Wow.
All right? So
it's
there you go.
It's a lot cheaper to have a durable power of attorney.
If she had a durable power of attorney and a health care proxy and a living will, we could do almost every single thing that you have to do if you went through a long, protracted, expensive guardianship proceeding. And God forbid, you know, the niece brings the action to be appointed Ann Helen's guardian, and nephew David decides, oh, I don't know about that. I think I'd be better than Susie. Now we have a contested guardianship proceeding. And I can tell you, you could put $30,000 on the table before you're going to be done paying the lawyers on that one. You know?
A durable power of attorney is a lot cheaper than all a guardianship, isn't it?
Yeah, it'll cost you about $250.
Right,
okay.
Right.
I mean, it's cheap insurance, believe me.
Absolutely, okay. Absolutely. Very good. Thank
anyway,
you so much, Harry, for
have
that
a great,
info.
Have a great Labor Day weekend. Enjoy
and
the rest of
you.
Summer. And
appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. I appreciate it. Anyway, we're coming up on the top of the hour here, so I would just... again, hope everybody, I don't know, doing a barbecue this weekend, John, or no? The weather forecast is not too
no, it's not too good
too
today.
Promising.
Today is a good day to barbecue. Tomorrow's iffy, and Monday
tomorrow
is awful.
And Monday looks terrible.
Oh, it's going to rain like crazy.
Yeah, we were going to have some friends over and do something, but I don't know. We may have to postpone it until next weekend.
Well, either that or have them indoors and make lasagna. It's... I don't know.
Sometime I'll bring you my meat sauce, my bolognese
Ooh,
sauce.
Oh, I'd love to try it.
I'm not
it,
even Italian,
you?
But I make a pretty decent bolognese
Ooh,
sauce.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. I'm ready. I'm ready.
Definitely. So, anyway, I will, I don't know, hope you're here next week, but we'll be back next week. In the meantime, don't forget, if you go online to our website, you can check out our webinars, which are going to be September 20, 21, 22. So they're not like for 2.5 weeks. But that particular week in September, the webinars are really helpful to people. And even if you can't make it at 2 o'clock, you can go on our website and you can, if you look up seminars, you can listen to older seminars that we've done in the past. So if you can't make it that day because you have another appointment or something, you can listen to the seminar the following day or the following week or whenever you want to do that. And I think what we try to do with, they're not particularly complicated. They only last maybe about 45, 50 minutes. And then I think sometimes there's questions at the end. But they really kind of give you a flavor. You know, a lot of people who listen to the radio show here are already clients of ours. They're people who have been listening to us for a long time. But, you know, I know we pick up new people from, you know, we keep picking up new people. And we're doing pretty well on that end. But... enjoy the holiday weekend, despite the weather, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.